Okay, well, you guys listened to a lot of some great stuff today. I'm going to have to catch up on it. Couldn't get any Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Reports, whatever method they're using to get their audio commentaries out. I haven't sussed it out yet. I know there's a couple of good ones. There's a good one about Syria that I read, but I haven't been able to get the audio for some reason. I guess I have to correspond with them or figure something out. So instead of that, as our usual beginning, we'll be hitting Amy Goodman's commentary, which in this mad week is about FCC hijinks. I rely on connections. Got some intercepted. They promised to take a break of 3 weeks, but apparently the craziness of the week or something, or the fact that Glenn Greenwald was up in New York and they got to sit down together in the intercepted studio, Jeremy Scahill, that is. Kind of a hero of mine, I guess. Dirty Wars, Blackwater, if you don't remember that, and his work on Democracy Now! Through the years. But I thought he was off on some kind of trip. He has a really sensitive interview with a woman that was Alexis O'Brien, who was an acute observer of the Chelsea Manning court-martial. She slept in her car so she could be close to the scene and got in line early. They were only letting a handful of people in. Election Protection Report, or Election Theft Report, I guess I should call it. Glenn Palast, did I say Glenn? I meant Greg Palast, did an interview this week with Dennis Bernstein and Flashpoint. I think it's hung on the fact that Kurt Kobach, opponent of election transparency, has been appointed vice chair or something of the election integrity task force that their Trumpster has put together. And it's pretty maddening. He, among other things, was the author of that awful Show Me Your Papers Arizona bill that was ruled unconstitutional. A guy corresponded me from Kansas, says that, well, he passes a lot of stuff and then spends millions of dollars defending them, and then they're found also unconstitutional in Kansas itself. Notice that Ari Berman in The Nation, the observer of the election system, has a major book on it, has called Wisconsin a theft because of voter suppression. It's kind of the untold story. The closeness of the election shouldn't have happened. Allowed it to be stolen again, it seems. All right, well, let's see if I can get through the haze here and start off with Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier essay. Let's be working on trying to get the regular feature Black Agenda Report up one of these days.
Donald Trump's agit pie prop. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. You're fired. When Donald Trump ousted FBI Director James Comey Tuesday night, it was more than just another of Trump's shocking executive actions. Comparisons to Watergate are chillingly relevant. Comey was investigating potential collusion between the Russian government and Trump's presidential campaign. Just days earlier, Comey asked the Justice Department, run by Trump crony Attorney General Jeff Sessions, for more resources for the investigation. Trump's termination of Comey echoed President Richard Nixon's firing of the special prosecutor investigating Watergate, Archibald Cox, in what was called the Saturday Night Massacre. Amidst the daily deluge of scandal, one detail remains clear. Donald Trump understands the power of the media, and he wields that power relentlessly. From the announcement of a Supreme Court nominee in a suspenseful event that could have been drawn from reality TV, to his incessant and inflammatory tweeting, Trump manipulates the media and, more often than not, controls the news cycle. His unpredictable pronouncements have captured the attention of the corporate media almost to the point where very little else gets covered. Behind the headline-grabbing chaos, though, decades of progressive policy achievements are being quietly undone by the army of loyalists that Trump is assembling around him. Over at the Federal Communications Commission, for example, newly installed chairman Ajit Pai is doing everything he can to eliminate rules protecting net neutrality on the internet while allowing big pro-Trump broadcasters to further consolidate. This will lead to increasingly restricted democratic dialogue in our society, further strengthening Trump's grip on power. Net neutrality is described by the media advocacy organization Free Press as the First Amendment of the Internet. It describes a fundamental feature of the Internet, allowing information to flow freely and equally over the web, regardless of its content. For example, whether you want to view web content from the National Rifle Association or the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, the site you're seeking will load equally quickly. The ISPs are not allowed to favor one site over another. Take another example. Many people watch video on the internet using Netflix, but imagine an ISP with ownership interest in another competing service deciding to slow down Netflix in order to frustrate those users and drive them to its service. With strictly enforced net neutrality rules, this type of conduct would be illegal. In the internet that Ajit Pai, a former Verizon lawyer, is trying to construct, with net neutrality rules scrapped, it would likely become the norm. Extremely well-funded incumbent sites would dominate, while smaller startup web ventures would find it impossible to compete. The internet's dynamism would disappear. To take the hypotheticals one step further, imagine an activist website dedicated to organizing resistance to President Trump's immigrant ban. Such a site now would be freely accessible. But without the protection of net neutrality, there would be nothing to stop an ISP from slowing down traffic to and from the site, rendering it useless. Broadcast ownership rules, also under the FCC's purview, are being targeted for elimination by Pai as well. On April 20th, the FCC voted 3-2 along partisan lines to relax broadcast ownership rules, unleashing a wave of TV station ownership consolidation. The Sinclair Broadcast Group is reportedly attempting to purchase Tribune Media for $4 billion, giving it control of more than a third of the country's local TV stations. Sinclair is more than just a TV network, though. It has for many years exploited the public airwaves to promote a right-wing political agenda.
They've rolled out the red carpet for President Trump.
That's Craig Aaron, president and CEO of Free Press, on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
Right after the election, Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and advisor, indicated that he'd struck a deal with Sinclair for favorable coverage, where they would air Trump speaking at length without interruption. So that's the kind of things that they've allowed. They've hired multiple Trump spokespeople, mouthpieces from the administration to come on the air, give the administration's views.
Broadcast networks are still the way that most people get their news, especially those who are less internet-connected, like older people and the poor. By supporting candidates like Donald Trump, Sinclair also ensures there'll be no drastic changes to campaign finance law. Every election cycle, then, Sinclair and other broadcasters reap huge windfalls from the flood of dark money spent on broadcast airtime to disseminate misleading political ads. This creates a vicious cycle, allowing anti-democratic, that's small d democratic, forces to tighten control of the broadcast networks and increasingly the internet. President Trump knows how to use the mass media and social media to manipulate public opinion and sway voters. But Trump and appointees like Ajit Pai are learning that there is a force more powerful, organized people taking to the streets. Trump can fire individuals who threaten his power, like James Comey, but he can't fire a movement. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay, working on the next hour and having some trouble again. How about that? I didn't have time to edit out the one expletive that Jeremy Scahill made today, but I'm going to try and edit that on the fly. It's in the 13th minute. I should be able to get to it. I'll just interrupt a phrase, I guess. I wanted to mention, well, let's see. I was supposed to be out of town today, but so I didn't. Well, I knew in the middle of the week, but I forgot about this event. And, Jonathan Katab is going to be in town. He's a Palestinian lawyer, and there we go. He's speaking at the First Mennonite Church from 5:30 to 7, light refreshments to follow. Also speaking and joining him is Steve Sherman, who is with the local chapter of Jewish Voices for Peace. He's the president of the Chad Meir Bennett chapter. He's been busy in Jewish communities in New Jersey and Oklahoma, it says here, for background on Steve Sherman. Jonathan Katab is an international human rights attorney and speaker. He's co-founder of the human rights group Al-Haq and the Mandela and Nonviolence International. He's also on the board of the Bethel Bible College, and he's guest preaching the next day. All right, finishing up his bio here, he is a member of the Bar Association New York, Israel, and Palestine. He has been a lawyer for the Christian Peacemaker teams in Palestine, if you remember hearing about them. We don't much anymore. I think they're still active. And it's a cross-country tour he's involved with, but they've got a local representative joint conversation at the Mennonite Church. Again, if I didn't get that in, it's on the corner of Lincoln and Springfield. All right. Hopefully I can make it there if I work things out in the meantime. And back to what I announced. And let's hear Greg Palast first, and then we'll hear from The Intercepted. Greg Palast, author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and also the filmmaker of the same film, basically called it that there was enough election suppression and variety of antics. Let's check it out. Actually, I've only sampled some sections of this, but it's been a while since we heard from him. This was a regular feature through the lead up to the election, and quite impressive, it seems to me. I think he says, let's let him say it, since it's already, blocking the clock, that's why. It's not on the right time. Maybe I'm here an hour early.
Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice.
30 seconds.
Go buy Ivanka's stuff is what I would tell. I'm going to go get some on myself today.
I don't even think it was controversial. You know, I proved them. I haven't even heard. I haven't had one call from anybody saying, that was a terrible thing you did.
Shut up! All right. And yes, welcome back to our ongoing forever election crimes bulletin with the best-selling author, filmmaker, Greg Palast. Greg, what could you possibly be busy doing? Do we need this bulletin anymore?
I wish we didn't. I'm ready. You know, I'm looking at my Medicare plan. Right? I'm done with this. You know, it's like they're not done with us. And so what's happening is that, you know, here's the problem. When you steal an election and you stop being a democracy, then what happens is then the dictators look around and say, well, wait, we need to, what can we steal? We stole an election, but you don't steal elections for votes. You steal it for the money. So now part two of the scheme is grinding into action. And we have not only Trump Care, which first was found face down in the swimming pool and has somehow been revived. And we also have, and this was last week's news, no one cares anymore, is the Trump cuts to taxes, Trump's so-called tax reform. And as soon as they say the word reform, reach for your wallet, because it means they're taking your money to give it to the rich guys. But here's how they're doing it. But they're saying, don't worry. There's a $2 trillion tax cut in this plan that Trump has, that Trump has proposed, $2 trillion. Now, his secretary, Steve Mnuchin, a demi-billionaire, has said that the tax cut, and this is a quote, will pay for itself with growth. That's a quote, will pay for itself. Now, where does he get this magic? You're going to cut the tax on the rich by $2 trillion. I'll tell you the details. But let's start with the idea that it pays for itself. Okay? Now, where does that come from? It comes from, and I'm not making this up, it comes from a napkin, a calculation done on a napkin, a little chart, by an economist, Art Laffer, who happened to have been my mentor, him and my other mentor, Milton Friedman. I can't make that up either. So Laffer and I were out having cheeseburgers because he's a cheeseburger addict, and he wrote on a napkin back in 1974 a little curve. It's called the Laffer curve, and or as George Bush Sr. called it, voodoo economics. The Laffer curve is known for saying the more you cut taxes, the more taxes you will actually collect. Tax cuts pay for themselves because rich people get all excited and they start investing and there's all this new growth in the economy because you cut taxes. The more you cut taxes, the more tax revenue you receive because when the economy grows, you're going to tax people, you know, the profits will come in, and it literally pays for itself. Now, that's a miracle.
And by the way, let me just remind people, they can see, if they want to see the drawing, they can go to gregpalace.com, which it accompanies an article about all this stuff.
That's right, they did Truth Out, and it was, and there's the Laffer curve. It's my reproduction, I must admit, because he did draw
a
napkin.
Okay.
And he used it for his, to clean up the burger juice.
Okay.
So all I have is a reproduction.
Okay, we're going to have to trust you on that.
It's real simple. Okay.
Okay.
Laffer is a smart guy, and believe it or not, he's not a magician. He cannot, even with a nice curve. It's a curve, see? So here's how it works, as Laffer explained it to me. If your taxes, like in Sweden, actually had taxes of 102% on the ultra-rich, so for every dollar they made, they actually lost a dollar, too. And in the U.S., we had taxes under that commie Eisenhower, where the rich paid 90% taxes, marginal taxes, they call it. The rich paid 90%. So what they're saying is, yeah, if you cut taxes from 102% to, say, 85% or 90% to 85%, you might actually get this effect because you've just about – basically you've made it so people have no reason to kind of invest or work when it's that high. But when it's that high, so you get some actually positive, you might get a positive effect where you collect more revenue than the tax, than the official tax cut. But if you go down the curve into what we have today, and the rich pay about 40% federal tax at the highest, that's the highest marginal rate. If you, on the Laffer curve itself, on the curve in the reality zone, you're going to lose your shirt. You're going to bankrupt the government to give rich people a tax cut. Now, how did voodoo economics happen? How did the napkin become national policy? The answer is that Laffer wrote on another napkin, and I'm not making this up, he wrote on another napkin. After he got together with a guy named Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney's no economist, and worse, Cheney showed it to a guy named Ronald Reagan, the governor of California, who then decided how exciting you could actually cut taxes and make, and it all comes back. So Reagan gave us the Laffer curve in at the laughing point. And of course, Reagan tried it out, and our national debt blew through the ceiling by giving tax cuts to the rich. And now we're back. We're back with napkinomics. There's no question that Trump has swallowed the whole napkin. And he's repeating it, and Mnuchin is literally repeating the wrong end of the Laffer curve. It's still voodoo economics, but they don't care because no one in the media actually seems to be challenging this crazy idea that it pays for itself growth. Or they say, well, some people say that's correct, and some people, you know, some economy, you know, they do that kind of.
So you're surprised that there's no critical questions. Is that what you want my audience to believe, that you're surprised about that?
Okay. No surprises, but here's the other part. Now we get it. Can I get into the details
of
what this guy's going to do?
Yes, please.
Okay. Let's look at a few of the taxes he's cutting. Let's start with something called the Alternative Minimum Tax, AMT. And guess what? He's going to cut the AMT tax, the alternative minimum tax, to zero. Now, only rich people pay this because the alternative minimum tax was created because there are a lot of corporations and with rich people, multimillionaires and billionaires, who are paying zero tax. And so this is a way to make the billionaires who use every loophole in the world and don't pay any tax to pay something. That's why it's called the alternative minimum tax. And there's a guy named Donald Trump. We have only 1 year of his tax return. And on that tax return showed he only paid one single tax, the AMT. And now he would eliminate that tax. So the only tax that Trump pays is the one he's zeroing out. And it's like, I haven't – who is talking about this? Who's discussing this? Now he goes another way. He did say, by the way, remember when he ran – he said, the tax code is unfair. It's bent towards rich guys like me and these Wall Street slackers, these speculators who don't add a single job to the economy. They're just speculators. The speculators get a special loophole called carried interest. Now, the number one beneficiary of carried interest, as far as I know, is a guy named Robert Mercer, who was the number one donor to the Trump campaign, a guy named Robert Mercer. Okay, who else? Paul Singer, that's a name you ought to remember from my other discussion. I hope you've been taking notes. The Vulture. Okay, Paul Singer, the Vulture. Vulture speculator. The guy that brought down the mortgage market, JP the Foreclosure King. These are the three big users of that loophole carried interest, which Donald Trump said again and again and again. He and a guy named Bernie Sanders said that loophole would be closed. Trump gets in the office, he doesn't. The new tax bill has nothing about closing that loophole. Instead, they make it bigger. They make it big enough to drive a truck through. They make it big enough to drive Trump Tower through, and I want to emphasize that point. They cut taxes on Trump Tower, too. So which is owned by a partnership. Partnership taxes have been dropped from a top line of 40% to 15%. The self-dealing here is on a trillion, and I want to repeat that, trillion-dollar scale of self-dealing. We've never seen anything like that. This is literally a break-in into the U.S. Treasury. Remember there was some film called the U.S. – I can't remember, some film about breaking into the Treasury and stealing the gold from Fort Knox. That's nothing. Stealing gold from Fort Knox is nothing compared to this grab, smash and grab.
No, they're moving. Look, Trump, you have to admit, Trump is a businessman first and foremost. And he's doing business. He hasn't noticed that he was even elected.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, he's the first guy to say that he was going to turn a profit on running for president. First candidate ever to turn a profit from running for president.
He said that?
Yeah, he said that. And he also, so now we know, he not only wanted to make a profit on running for president, he wants to make it tax-free. And, you know, the other thing is, and there's evil, other evils in here that it never stops. Like those guys who he said, the speculator, he never liked Wall Street speculators. He always had his casinos and he has, you know, brick and mortar. He didn't like these guys who made money just because they were really good in math, right? Or they were really, did creepy securities deals. So he always said they should be taxed, not me. But once he got in, because they were the guys who actually paid for the campaign. Remember, as they say, Trump is not a billionaire. He plays one on television. The thing is, there's a tax on speculators. The most progressive thing Obama did in his administration, never talked about it, was a 3.8% surtax on speculative profits. Why did Obama do that? Because speculators were his closest friends. The answer is, that's what pays for Obamacare. $15.7 billion goes into the Obamacare fund over 10 years. Trump is cutting it out through the tax code, which means even if Trump Care doesn't pass, Obamacare is going to be bankrupted because if they cut this tax on these Wall Street speculators, this special speculation tax, if they cut that, how is Obamacare going to survive, even if it never gets changed? There's no money for it. And then they'll say, oh, look, Obamacare failed. Now, look, as far as I'm concerned, Obamacare is a kind of failure, but It's definitely better than the nothing we had, and definitely better than the
less than nothing we're about to have. Greg,
that's right.
we've got a few minutes left, and I actually, if you are definitely the preeminent, you've got your postdoctoral degrees in stolen elections. The Democratic Clinton machine is still on the one and only the Russians. If it wasn't for the Russians stole the election. Who do you think stole the election from who? Was there an election?
Well, I have no choice but to plug my film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Yeah, the election was stolen straight up, and it wasn't, by a guy doing the Kozatsky. The Trump's minions had some terrific vote thieving plans, in particular stealing the black vote and preventing black people from voting. Number one, we've talked a lot about the program called CrossCheck. That cost 1.1 million minority voters their registration. And by the way, it's getting worse. Texas is looking to bring it on. New Hampshire, the last day in office of the Republican governor, after she's thrown out of office, but before she left, signed CrossCheck into operation. So it's not done with. These tricks are going to be worse. So it's tricks like CrossCheck. It was tricks by refusing to put students, for example, students by the millions on the voter rolls in different states through different forms of trickery, demanding proof of citizenship. That's pretty hard unless you have a passport in America, that type of thing. And so that's what took the election. And, you know, it would be nice to say the Russians did it. But, you know, also I have to say that the election could not be stolen if Hillary hadn't made it close enough to steal.
Thank you.
Vlad Putin who told Hillary, don't go to Wisconsin at all during the campaign. It wasn't Putin who told Hillary Clinton to tell people in Detroit, Michigan, that they should be happy about free trade agreements. Okay? The Russians didn't do this. And let's remember one other thing. Okay? Whatever you think of Julian Assange or his biases or not, he runs an agency, a news agency whose job is to produce hidden material that's secreted from the public, evidence of crimes. And one of the things that he produced were the documents, and I don't care whether they came via Russia or not, they are absolutely authentic. And this is the problem, that the DNC was collaborating illegally, and I want to emphasize illegally, with the Clinton campaign to destroy Bernie Sanders. Illegally, okay? And in fact, in court, in a Florida court this week, it was just shocking. There were donors to the Democratic Party who were also Sanders donors who found out that their money was stolen from the DNC coffers with the connivance of the DNC officials, like Wasserman Schultz, and given to the Hillary campaign, which is against the law. They defrauded the DNC to give the money to Hillary. These Bernie Sanders supporters who also gave to the Democratic Party sued. And the Clintons' lawyers and the DNC's lawyers said, well, we can do that. We don't have to play fair. We secretly support one candidate over another, even though in our own bylaws it says that the DNC may not take a position or favor one candidate or another in a primary. That's the DNC's bylaws. And people donated money to the DNC saying, well, no matter who wins or loses, you know, we want to support the Democratic Party. They didn't know that their money was being ripped off, and the DNC didn't deny the allegations. Rather, they said, we can do that. That's what lost this election. When Bernie's voters heard that they were being shafted and young people were being shafted and their issues being ignored, they didn't come out to vote. When Hillary Clinton refused to stand up against the mass suppression of the Latino vote, of the black vote, of the Asian American vote, she was dead silent and absolutely comatose on protecting these minority voters. Well, of course you're going to make it close enough to steal.
It's amazing. You are listening to, what are we calling this? The post-election crimes bulletin, the next big crime coming into. There's really going to be a battle in 218 based on all the sort of the policy issues that are being kicked around now, right, Greg? So
It is absolutely getting worse on the vote protection front, and now we have a Justice Department which is becoming the Injustice Department.
Yeah, oh my gosh.
Look out.
Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III has never seen a voting booth he likes in a black or brown community. Did I say that?
Yeah. And, well, he's actually said that we don't need the Voting Rights Act at all.
Yeah.
It's been gutted, but it's still there. It still has some value. But he says we don't need it at all. Well, of course, when he says we, he doesn't include a lot of part of the public that has less than lily white skin, and this is a big problem. You also have, by the way, a new attack, this endless new attack on the votes of students, which is not small. And they say, gee, young people don't vote. Well, go ahead and try to register in Georgia, my friends. This is one of the problems, where they make it a practical impossibility to register to vote. And we saw this Chris Kobach, who is Trump's henchman, and he runs the kind of vote theft lab out of Kansas. He knocked out 36,000 students who did not have proof of citizenship when they registered, because they can't find their original birth certificate from some other state, or they don't have a passport because they're young and they don't have the money, they didn't come back from their vacation in the Alps recently. So they had no proof of citizenship. Remember, driver's license is not a proof of citizenship. Social Security card, not a proof of citizenship. Aliens do have these cards. They must. So it's pretty hard to prove you're a citizen in America. And that has knocked out tens of thousands of students. And this guy, Kobach, had a secret meeting with Donald Trump in Trump Tower.
This is when?
They take this in January, just before the inauguration. And by the way, I'm trying to get the papers. He gave the secret memo. He gave a memo to Trump on how to expand this vote blocking system, which will knock out a million students nationwide if they use the rule that they started.
How do you know there's that document?
Well, because he's a kind of sometimes too clever by half. Chris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas, in his meeting with Trump, Trump was doing the usual pictures in front of, in front of his door of his office.
That's right.
And Kobach actually had the memo in his hand, but face out, the cover of the memo. And we could see when you blow it up about 40, 50 times, you could see that the memo says, amend the National Voter Registration Act, otherwise known as Motor Voter. And we know exactly from court cases what it is he wants to do with that act. Eliminate it or amend it so that you can require citizenship proof. And you know what? A federal judge blocked about half of his vote purge of these young voters because they didn't have passports or citizenship proof, because she said, you have tens of thousands of people here that you're blocking from registering. Can you name one single one in that entire list who's an alien voter, who's not a citizen? If you can name one, let this, you can have your rule. He couldn't name one out of the thousands of people he blocked.
And let me again jump in because we're running out of time. And this, of course, is the heart of the matter of the film that you did, Greg. This is what is so really troubling, that this program continues, that this guy continues apace. I mean, you called him out, you confronted him, everything you said about him was true, but he's still in there. He's still in there.
Well, because his man is in there. I mean, remember, the film was released in September before the election, saying, here's how Trump's going to steal it. And as you know, if filmmakers out there will know, hey, man, you have to make a film about that. You have to know that a year in advance. So a year in advance, we could see that Trump was going to grab the nomination and win the White House, because we could see we weren't looking at polls. We were looking at the theft. We were looking at how they were step by step, ballot by ballot, how this election would be shoplifted for the ultra-rich who are now getting the payoff in this so-called tax reform plan.
All right, I'm going to leave it right there. More information, gregpalace.com. You can find out about Greg's latest writings, the film, everything that they are into. We appreciate this bulletin that we have now, the time, call it from time to time, but important information. We will keep doing it until the next election arises. Thank you, Greg.
You got it, Chip. Bye.
From KPFA in Berkeley, that's Dennis Bernstein, my go-to guy with flashpoints. It's available on SoundCloud, though that doesn't work really well for me either. So that's from the Best of Edition, which I think they generally put up on radioforall.net, where you can find a lot of interesting stuff if you're so inclined. It's kind of old-school anarchy broadcast site. All right, I'm going to edit this on the fly. As I mentioned, The Intercepted came back. They said they were going to be on hiatus, but I guess pressure of the events and Glenn Greenwald's presence in New York City got them into the studio again. Alexis O'Brien, as I mentioned, was there talking about Bradley Manning. I didn't mention when I pitched that for your attention, though I'm not going to... well, I got texted and distracted. Oh, my. All right. Mother's Day. I was going to play this Mother's Day audio that I have from. There are two initiatives apparently. One of them was a pretty radical initiative for Mother's Day, anti-war, in revulsion of the Civil War, if memory serves. But I guess I ought to book that before I talk about it any further. Let's see, today, tomorrow, 2 to 4, there's an art opening, the Labor Education Program, I guess that's at the U of I, and the Independent Media Center have teamed up for a program as part of the Art of Labor series, sponsored by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Company of Folk. What the heck is the Company of Folk? I guess you might have to go to find out. That's, again, 2 to 4 at the IMC. Join painter, printmaker Hector Duarte for the public art of muralist Hector Duarte. Okay. And more info and a link to the Facebook page, wef.org/PSA. Okay. Well, I can click on that link here and see if it works. No, it doesn't work for me in this form. Maybe I'll do that on the outro because that sounds interesting. We're speaking of labor, and I guess I just did. The Labor Hour is now on RFU, which is hosted over at the IMC. And it's on the next hour, the hour they always used to have here. Haven't mentioned them in a while, but labor is really important. There was some success at the U of I. A couple of things around the country in public sector unions. All right, 22 minutes. I'm going to be editing this on the fly. You can just go to The Intercept and look for the podcast, The Intercepted. They're still asking you to get it through iTunes or one of your podcast deliverers where you can do a review of it as opposed to getting it directly from them, I guess. So check it out. There is still something called Google Play. I don't know. Maybe you use it. Thanks for listening. I hope you're enjoying the... It feels like May out for once, so maybe a little warm. No weather report. I still haven't noticed. In fact, maybe I'll do that while I'm listening to this with you. Check to see if the local climate march video is up at the UPTV. Maybe the musicians over there are still working on the sound, which was not so good. Again, Jonathan Kutab, a Palestinian lawyer, on a nationwide tour, joined locally by Mr. Sherman, a doctoral student, who is with Jewish Voices for Peace. In fact, he's president of the local chapter. I'm not going to try to pull up the details, but that's at the Mennonite Church from 5:30 to 7:30 this Saturday evening. So it's an early evening thing. You can maybe party afterwards. There's light refreshments and conversation after the discussion between or the presentations by those two gentlemen. All right. Here's the Intercepted, and as is their wont, they start with a little audio art, and this includes a reference to Twin Peaks, which I'm totally culturally deprived from, so I don't understand the references, but maybe you do.
Previously on Twin Peaks.
It's dead.
She's dead. Wrapped in plastic.
It's essentially dead.
Laura Palmer.
Diane, 11:30 a.m., February 24th.
You wear shiny objects on your chest.
Beautiful. Just so beautiful.
Are you proud?
Well, I was very well known, as you understand, prior to this, but that was a different world. This is something you are really in your own little world.
My log has something to tell you. Do you know it?
It's a great guy, good heart, tough guy, but a good heart, great heart.
Do not introduce the log.
Well, there's truth to that. There is truth to that.
Can you hear it?
You look, there's a certain openness, but there's nobody out there. But I've never seen anybody out there, actually.
Do you understand?
Look, you can figure it out yourself. What the hell is going on?
Deliver the message.
Well, everyone thinks that this is very ominous right here. See this? These are phones. These are very, you know, secure phones. But this is a very ominous looking because of the red button. But it gets you something. You can take it any way you want. It's enough. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Time for a cup of Joe and a donut. Twin Peaks will be right back.
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill, coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 14 of Intercepted. On Tuesday night, the FBI director, James Comey, was in Los Angeles, and he saw on television screens news that he had just been fired by President Donald Trump. Trump, simultaneous to the news breaking, reportedly sent a letter to the FBI officially informing James Comey that he was no longer, effective immediately, no longer the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And in Trump's letter to Comey, he said, "While I greatly appreciate you informing me on three separate occasions that I am not under investigation, I nevertheless concur with the judgment of the Department of Justice that you are not able to effectively lead the Bureau." This is sort of an incredible statement in and of itself. It's as though Comey's job was to fluff Trump about his alleged non-existent role in the so-called Russia scandal. Trump is referencing a letter that Jeff Sessions supposedly independently sent to Trump saying he supports the recommendation of the newly appointed deputy attorney general, who wrote a memo justifying why James Comey should be removed from office. And in that memo, which has now been made public by the Trump administration, the deputy attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, says that Director Comey, and he's referring to James Comey here, "I cannot defend the director's handling of the conclusion of the investigation of Secretary Clinton's emails, and I do not understand his refusal to accept the nearly universal judgment that he was mistaken. Almost everyone agrees that the director made serious mistakes. It is one of the few issues that unites people of diverse perspectives." What he's referring to is James Comey's public announcement in the midst of the final stages of the presidential campaign that the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails had been closed with no charges being brought. Now, of course, Obama was still in power. Loretta Lynch was the attorney general. Comey said she had a conflict. What he did was proper. The Trump people are now saying, no, that wasn't. And they cite both Democratic and Republican former attorneys general in supporting this decision. There's a lot to unpack here. I'm joined by my colleague and fellow co-founder of The Intercept, Glenn Greenwald, who is with us here in New York for a change.
It's my debut appearance in Inside the Intercepted Studios. It's very exciting.
So now, Glenn, of course, the Democrats all are immediately piling on, and it's that Comey was getting too close, the noose was tightening around Trump's neck over the Russia investigation, and that Comey basically needed to be taken out by Trump before the smoking gun was presented to the American public that would impeach and probably imprison Donald Trump. What's your immediate reaction to this news?
I mean, I'm someone who generally doesn't find much of what Trump has done to be shocking, given what he said he would do during the campaign and who he revealed himself to be. But this actually is shocking. So I as much as I'd like to, I can't really blame people for scrambling around for an actual theory. The theory that you just identified, which is that, oh, he had to sabotage Comey, he was about to find or reveal the smoking gun, makes no sense to me whatsoever. The premise is that James Comey and only James Comey is aware of this smoking gun, and that as long as you fire him, somehow then you prevent its disclosure. When, of course, other people who work with Comey, other people in various departments would also be aware of this evidence if it existed, and James Comey himself, now that he's fired, could ensure its disclosure. So that I don't find persuasive, but I also don't find persuasive the DOJ's explanation for why they did it, namely these criticisms of Comey, many of which are actually valid, namely that he took it upon himself to decide that the investigation should end.
Right. And he announced that what the Trump people are basically saying, well, there's two main components to this. On the one hand, they're saying you were wrong to announce to the public that we're closing this investigation into the Hillary Clinton email scandal, which became just the harpy point for Trump in the closing stages.
It's a process objection, right? They're not saying you were wrong to close the investigation, although they do think that. They're saying it wasn't up to you, James Comey. Even if Loretta Lynch couldn't make it, it was up to somebody else to make it. So that's one objection that is not invalid. And the other one is that when he decided to close the investigation against Hillary Clinton, instead of just saying so, he gave all kinds of opinions about the case that were all very negative to Hillary. And a lot of people think it was wrong for Comey to comment on an investigation that he decided to close. But the thing about it is, even though those criticisms of Comey are valid, the Trump people don't care about that at all. They loved when he stood up in public and denounced and criticized Clinton once the case was closed. And they don't care at all about these process objections. So although I don't agree with the Democrats that the reason is to prevent Comey from being on the verge of the smoking gun, I also don't think that the Republican explanations for why this happened are even a small amount valid. And so it leaves the question, why did this happen and why did it happen now? And I don't think we know the answer to that yet.
Right. And let's remember that there's a lot of smoke and there's a little bit of fire with some of the people that are around Trump, Paul Manafort. You have Carter Page. General Flynn is floating out there in the ether and has reportedly been actively seeking immunity. And I think this is an interesting question about where Flynn resides in all of this, because we haven't heard from him in public. But remember, General Flynn was the first high profile military figure who had served in a very senior position under Obama and was fired by Obama. He was the first to jump onto the Trump train. He did public interviews with him on the road. He bolstered his military credentials. You know, Trump really was kind of taking Flynn's lead on a lot of what he was saying about American foreign policy and the military. Flynn may be a lot of things, but he is not an imbecile. And he was around for a lot of private stuff that was happening in Trump land leading up to his election and then leading up to the inauguration. I'm just curious if part of this is that there actually is a move to take down not Trump, but that there is some action against someone that's incredibly important to Trump. They're concerned that Flynn is flipping, that Comey seems to be playing too nice with the Democrats and publicly debunking the president's tweets in front of Congress. Trump's a spiteful guy. He wants fierce loyalists. But is it your sense that there is no Russia connection to the firing of James Comey?
So again, I mean, there are clearly serious Russia questions when it comes to people like Paul Manafort, who I think primarily has problems because of his financial dealings and undisclosed lobbying work. Carter Page is just some kind of extraterrestrial troll freak that has little to do with the Trump campaign, except in name only, who probably has all kinds of nefarious implications. So I wouldn't be surprised if Comey was investigating and making some headway when it comes to people like Manafort, Carter Page, even Roger Stone. Again, though, on the question of Was there collusion between the Trump campaign at the highest levels, the kind that would get him into serious political trouble or impeach him, and the Russian government? It makes no sense to me whatsoever that if you're worried that evidence is about to be discovered, that's some kind of a smoking gun or something close, that anyone would think that a solution to that would be getting rid of James Comey. He works with dozens of other investigators in various agencies, including the Department of Justice. So even if you got rid of him, that evidence isn't going anywhere. So that theory just doesn't seem persuasive to me.
Right. And then there is the fact that much of what we know about Trump's, you know, recent public history is from his television show, The Apprentice, where the whole point of the show was you're fired, you're fired, you're fired, you're fired. And so, you know, some of that is at play here. But I do wonder if the Trump people think they're outmaneuvering the Democrats, the lying fake news media, and that there is some intention of creating this kind of chaos right now as kind of their best defense against any number of legitimate issues that are being probed of this administration.
That, I think, makes sense. In other words, if you speak to anybody who has ever worked with Trump, what they say is he demands this kind of compulsive, unhealthy level of loyalty. Anyone who he thinks is disloyal to him, he fires. So I think that's been a big part of what they've been doing, is trying to weed out, you know, the Sally Yates of the world, people who they think have loyalties elsewhere, and replace them with hardcore Trump loyalists. And I think they've seen that James Comey prides himself on not being a loyalist to anybody. And there's a lot going on at the FBI, and they want someone in there who they trust a lot more than they trust him. That's what I think makes a lot more sense.
I think it's clear that that in firing James Comey, if it is related to Russia, either Trump has done the most outrageously stupid thing he could have done by not keeping his enemies closer and turning potentially Comey into an unprecedented sort of whistleblower, yeah, if he comes out publicly, or Trump is a genius and there isn't anything there with him on Russia. And by firing Comey, he's going to send the Democrats into a tizzy, the press into a tizzy, and there will be some, you know, pawns that fall on the board as a result of it. But if Trump really knows that there's no there with his Russia, maybe he is smarter than everybody thinks.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, you know, if you're Donald Trump, you have to be pretty comfortable about the question of collusion. You have all kinds of people saying, and not Trump loyalists, but people like James Clapper and even Dianne Feinstein 2 weeks ago to Wolf Blitzer, that look, no, they have not seen evidence of collusion. And if there were evidence of collusion, you know, some kind of intercepted telephone call between some Trump spawn and someone in the Kremlin talking about hacking, you can be damn sure that would have leaked by now.
Well, or, you know, but then there's also the idea that they have a video of Trump with, you know, prostitutes, or the sort of P video and all of that. I mean, who, you know, there's everything is out there.
Right.
The last thing I'll say as we wrap up here, Glenn, is I continue to just be astonished, even though I shouldn't, at how willing so many cable news journalists, particularly on MSNBC, but also Democrats, are willing to believe any shit that's flung against the wall of Trump, that it makes that wall look horrible. They'll believe it. And I think it's going to undermine the real issues that are there. I think there is a legitimate investigation that should be had.
I think we've talked about this before, but, you know, it reminds me so much of the Benghazi investigation, where there were serious national security questions about what happened in Benghazi, why they were there, why they ended up killed, that got completely suffocated by the unhinged conspiracy theorizing and just obsessive fixation the Republicans developed on Benghazi on totally unrelated issues. That, to me, is exactly what is happening when it comes to Russia. All of the legitimate questions that ought to be investigated have been swamped and suffocated, you know, by the Keith Olbermans and the Louise Menches of the world who think that there's a Putin agent hiding under every corner and who make all kinds of evidentiary connections. You might want to throw Rachel Maddow in there too, notwithstanding the fact that there's no rational basis for doing so. And they look like Glenn Beck in 2010 as they do it, standing at the chalkboard.
Well, Glenn, I do want to also share with our listeners that when we first started The Intercept, you said that you wanted to be paid in rubles. And I appreciate your honesty about who you want your paymasters to be.
And I appreciate that you had in your home this massive vault of rubles from the work that you've done over the years that you were able to use to pay me. And I appreciate that as well.
All right. Well, Comrade Glenn, I'll see you at our next summit in Moscow. Glenn Greenwald, thank you for being with us on Intercepted.
Great to be with you.
Glenn, of course, is my fellow co-founder of The Intercept. Next week, on May 17th, prisoner 89289 is scheduled to walk out of the Leavenworth Military Prison in Kansas. Back in 2013, that prisoner was handed the longest sentence ever in U.S. history for being a whistleblower. The bulk of that 35-year sentence that was handed down at the end of a U.S. military court-martial was commuted by President Barack Obama. The prisoner I'm talking about is U.S. Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning. Now, there's a lot of talk in the news right now about leaks and about Julian Assange and about WikiLeaks. And we hear from Julian Assange. He is able to respond to allegations against him. We hear from the NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. Both of them were on our show last season. But we almost never have heard from Chelsea Manning since she was arrested in 2010 by the U.S. military in Iraq. We have almost never heard her voice. She was arrested while on active duty in the Army on suspicion that she had been the source for what at the time was the most explosive series of national security leaks in U.S. government history. Chelsea Manning was ultimately charged by the military and presented with an avalanche of allegations, charges, including very serious ones like aiding the enemy. The documents that she admitted in court to providing to WikiLeaks beginning in 2010 included hundreds of thousands of classified U.S. State Department cables, videos of U.S. military forces bombing or gunning down civilians, war crimes committed by U.S.-backed forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. She uncovered covert wars, the U.S. attempt to conceal its role in the bombing of Yemen beginning in the first year of the Obama administration. Since 2010, Manning has been held in various prisons and facilities, beginning in Iraq, then Kuwait, then back to the United States. And while she was in the custody of the military before her court-martial, she alleged that she was at times abused by her jailers. Some of the worst episodes, she says, occurred when she was held by U.S. Marines in Quantico, Virginia, before her trial. When Chelsea Manning was arrested, no recording equipment was allowed in court. Many of the publications that benefited from her whistleblowing, they put it on the front pages of their newspapers, they barely covered her trial. The narrative about who Chelsea Manning was and who she is has been largely set by the military, by the government, and also by cable news. Coverage of her has not, for the most part, focused on what she did or why she did it. But rather, what is presented is this sort of despicable fixation on the fact that Chelsea Manning is transitioning from living as a man to living as a woman.
You know this guy, Bradley Manning?
Yes.
Yeah, he's now Chelsea Manning.
Oh, all really? Right.
This isn't really justice. Yeah, it's therapy.
Traitor. He's a busted.
He's gave a traitor.
Up.
Correction. It was Chelsea Manning, not Bradley Manning, who did that.
Oh, yes. He has changed, or she has changed.
Oh, that's right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well done, Andy.
Thank you.
Yes. How are your treatments going, by the way?
Well, they're not as quick as I would like.
Right. When can we start calling you, Andrea?
The Associated Press, NBC, and the New York Times agreeing to call Manning she, but he's not a she.
Technically, on just definitional grounds, technically, it's he.
We recently obtained several hours of secretly recorded audio from the court-martial of Chelsea Manning. Now, there have been a couple of other leaks of audio from those proceedings, but most of what you're going to hear today from her has never before been broadcast. To discuss all of this, to discuss Chelsea Manning, her whistleblowing, her trial, and her treatment at the hands of her jailers, we're joined now by the researcher and writer, Alexa O'Brien.
Well, I hope that was a tease for you, as it were. I guess I shouldn't be light after hearing that despicable, expletive-deleted segments from various cable channels. I guess O'Reilly was one of the voices there. I've never listened to him enough to really identify him that well, but I think it was. That was from The Intercepted. You can find that, and I guess there might be an archive of the audio that he was referring to. They're going to play some segments in this episode 14 of The Intercepted. Go to The Intercept and look for the podcast, The Intercepted. Thanks for listening. We've got a minute or so left. Got a community announcement to mention, and then a community support from the blind man. Let's see. There's a series shown around the country.